description, the stories are tall. Better catch your grip. Better catch your pole. Catch your pole.
I was on a train, a late night train in Connecticut, going into New York City. And the conductor came along and I wanted to buy the ticket and I said, I'd like a ticket, senior citizen ticket. Now the feeling I had as I asked for that was the exact feeling I had had when I was 18 years old. When I was living in Massachusetts, but I went to New York with some friends and I went into a bar because I was old enough to drink in New York but not in Massachusetts, and I said, I'd like a beer, sort of like, you know, may I? And he said, let me see your identification. But so I said, I'd like a senior citizen ticket. And he said, and he just started to punch it out, and I said, aren't you going to ask my identification? And he said, no.
Sandcastles and a tide of nationalism is on the way in. It is curious foreign policy to use metaphors in defense of a war.
And murder, which haunted a small group of men, not American cowboys, but Jewish immigrants. This is the story of the founders of Hollywood, the story of the idea that became their America.
America to me. A name, a map, or a flag I see. A certain word, democracy. What is America?
Crushed. Because what happens is there is a sameness in the way we experience ourselves inside, even as our outside is changing. And that turns out to be a just a fascinating phenomenon. About change.
Suspended steel scrotum.
As we change our looks outside, people treat us differently. And I remember the first time when I was about 30, when some young kid said, "Yes, sir." Oh my God, I'm a sir. You know? And I think until I was about 50, I saw myself as about somewhere between 12 and 14.
Hello, this is Kristen Glover at WZCBC. I don't think I got it.
WZBC.
Glover, and you're listening to WZBC.
Classical jazz, yeah. And she was using bebop music, and that was different. That was real different. So
what did you see in Urban's bop dancing?
Oh, well, I mean, I didn't look at it as I really came very ignorant to tap. So a tapper was a tapper, you know, and I was connected to it. I've seen it all my life, you know. I know it, you know. We hooked and tapped in our day when we were younger. It wasn't a thing of, you know, other than being impressed that he had, you know,
Crispin Glover
skills as a tapper and going, wow, you know, check him out, yo. And, you know, I think it was more, what was impressing for me was the day we got together and everyone was there and we had a DJ, a bucket drummer, and...
about 11, and we looked like adults, but we knew who we were.
Don't. days, whatever old days they may be.
Is concerned, a lot of movements and styles are indigenous to the city, and so it may not be, so there's no universal tongue for me to communicate to say, well, can you do this certain
thing?
Sort of
all I need to say is there were no...
So Africa dance is the, you know, that you invite the individualism. You know, you may be doing the same movement, but is a, I mean, you may be doing the same style and technique, but it's a different movement. So in the individual lives within it.
Right.
Other dances seem to be very structured, and this is the way you have to do it.
When he is not actually fighting, but breathing against the ropes. And when he goes back into the real time of fighting again, we would go back to 24. We had about, God, I don't know, dozens of fights. And we had a different style for each one. And one was all going to be, one was all going to be like this and like this and like that with the lens. One was going to be all following him around. One was going to be steady. He started in the dressing room. He walks all the way with him. He lit the whole thing, and he stands on a big crane, and the crane lifts him up in the air and all that. It was great fun. It was wonderful. And it was an example of that thing that Marty can really do like no one else. Know what the emotional storytelling of a shot is really going to be, and that you don't need to do anything but this one shot. And it's so good and so evocative and so powerful emotionally that it'll get you from A to B without any coverage, without any worry.
Defend the ground! Defend the ground! photography is a single art, like painting, like writing, like music. Cinematography is a communal art. I think is not an art form that can be expressed by one single person. So, of course, there is the director, which is like the main author of the entire common expression, because having several persons that express themselves in the same art form, everybody can go in different direction. So from the writer to the musician, to the production designer, to the costume designer, to the cinematographer, to the editor, someone should be responsible.
Jazz.
Right.
You have the structure, yes. But then you may deviate. To say, well, can you do this certain?
But all I mean to say is there were no.
So Africa dance is the you invite the individualism. You know, you may be doing the same movement, but you may be doing the same style and technique, but it's a different movement. So the individual lives within it.
Right.
With other dances, it seems to be very structured, and this is the way you have to do it. With African, black traditional dance, there is no structure. There's structure without having structure. That's the whole of jazz.
Right.
You have the structure, but then you may deviate.
WZBC out of Newton. Fly by night. I think that's the cue. The way the weather blows. Out of Newton. WZBC. No commercial potential. Part two. Going till 2 o'clock. New Metaphysics, 552-4686. For dirty phone calls, let's see what you got out there. I, Gary Geiserman, at the controls. And there we have the essential information. All the rest, total effluvia, has no value, merely politeness in today's world. The world that I was born into, through choice, let's not make any mistake about that. We always choose our parents and all those specifics. I mean, what did you think? It was random? Like Darwinism or some kind of fiction? Let's get over that, grown-ups out there. I will not tolerate moronism any longer. Give me truth or give me schizophrenia. Give me schizophrenia or give me quadrophenia. And on the beat goes, my friends. I'm just repeating what you told me. Long, long, many moons ago. Once upon a time. In the West, the Western lands of our forefathers. In the covered wagons. Rugged, individualizationism from Northern Europe all the way. Straight ahead, brother. Raise that erection above the tree line, my friend. And give a holler. Instead of something else, we live in an erectile world of death-inducing scarcity. You do not know how to think beyond scarcity. Very strange consciousness, indeed.
That's the differences between what is traditional African dance, which is now Black America, and what is, you know, Irish America or Italian America, whatever. You
there may be racial comments during this evening's programming, so if there are any adults around, you might want to protect them from the material. Send them to bed early tonight.
Different structure.
Right.
It was really a closing chapter, very specific. Not only because it was the longest, it was the most far away, it was the most difficult, it was the most expensive, it was the most dangerous movie I ever done, but also probably the most emotional one. Mainly the first section of my life was mainly dealing with light, with all these possibilities the light has been in to express itself.
And with which I can make anonymous transactions.
Samuel Goldwyn, born Goldfish. Although Goldwyn never ran a major studio, he was perhaps the biggest and best known of the independent Hollywood producers.
It was worse than that. The escalation in February began immediately after the Viet Cong attacked our air base near Pleiku and killed 7 American soldiers.
And so if you walk into a room and you are sensing that there are a variety of new faces and perhaps answers are not given or questions are not asked in a certain fashion, it can seem now that things are off balance or whatever from perspective you wish to judge. But that is not necessarily so. There are always those who stand in many different perspectives to view an event. And each one of those perspectives has validity for where that individual is in their own development.
ZCBC. I don't think I got there.
WZBC.
Nasty things, I do neither. I live in the Hollywood Hills, and I have a house in Italy. So you could argue that perhaps I don't live in the country at all, as the Hollywood Hills are often exempted from being all America. But I am very much a participant in the affairs of this country. And it strikes me you're going after sex a bit early in the morning. This is for later in the day.
Well, we're
people at 11:10 don't want to hear. They'd much rather not hear about oral sex, but they would want to listen, perhaps, to Oral Roberts, which I regard as much worse. But, quiet it down, old boy.
Okay. The point is simply that you're and I...
Going on as partisan politics are smearing him for interesting reasons. And they're using sex as perhaps the easiest way of getting at him. I would think that the most interesting aspect of it is that the people are so much smarter than the media, people like yourself, who think they can get riled up about a president's sex life when all they care about are taxes and jobs and the economy. He has 80% popularity and... Judge Starr has about 11% approval rating. If I were the media, I would begin to wonder why it is the people don't agree with me instead of constantly dripping poison into their ears. I can answer my own question because the media is owned by the same corporations that own the country, that pay for the Congress, that pay for our single party. With two right wings, one called Republican, one called Democrat. The people are ahead of us. Heaven knows how they did it. Two-thirds, they don't vote in election times. The majority does not vote. They've given up on the system, and they don't believe any of you people. And I think that's great. I would rather see a decent republic, a representative government. But we lost that in 1950 when Harry Truman... turned us into a militarized national security state.
You begin to make this thing sound very conspiratorial.
Of course it is. Now, I realize the word conspiratorial.
I'm for conspiratorial analyses, and oftentimes there are. I think you could make a... Go ahead.
What on earth do you think a political party is but a conspiracy to achieve power?
You're talking about the media, though.
I'm talking about the media because I know a great deal about it. I've been at it a lot longer than you have.
Go for it.
The conspiracies, they're so clear. When Mrs. Clinton said about a right-wing conspiracy, well, the phrase right-wing doesn't make much sense. Nobody knows quite what the right-wing is or the left-wing. The conspiracy, however, was very plain. I'll spell it out as briefly as I can.
Okay.
When the Clintons decided to do something for the American people that needed doing, which was a national health service, something that every civilized country has, but we're not allowed to have. We can't have it because one-third of all the money that the average American spends on health goes to the insurance companies. The insurance companies are the piggy banks of the great corporations that own and run the country. ITT, for instance, owns Hartford Life.
The Clintons, by coming up with something that the people really don't understand but would like to have, were shocked. And they decided, A, to kill the bill. So they went into a conspiracy. You remember Harry and Louise? $500 million worth of ads on television. Well, that was a conspiracy to raise the money, put them on to destroy the bill. Harry, does this mean that we can't have kindly Dr. Haskins who delivered Buster Boy? I'm afraid, Louise, that's just what it means. Harry, that's communism. Well, that was a conspiracy to destroy the legislation, which it did.
Now we know who wrote the Harry and Louise commercials.
Well, no, which you acted in so well, I thought, too.
No, but wait a second. I believe in conspiracies, but not that one. The fact of the matter was that Hillary Clinton exempted the insurance companies from a real reform. She signaled at the very beginning.
She did not. I have a copy of the final legislation which they thought they could get through. Compromises, far too many had been made on the Clinton side. No, had they had any sense.
That's my point.
They would have declared war on the insurance companies.
Which they didn't
nobody
do,
in America,
the whole point.
Because they suddenly got scared of the amount of money being spent against them. And
but they gave up preemptively, I think.
I said from that moment on, they will smear you from every different direction as a couple, tried to defeat you, failed at that. The smear will continue. It's nothing personal. They don't care anything about Mr. and Mrs. Clinton. They are sending a message to any politician in the United States, if you try to give national health or anything to the people back for the tax dollars that they collect, we're going to get you. And they are scared to death out there, the politicians. And you'll never find anything like that happening again. And we are somewhere along with Togoland and Paraguay in our health care.
Roger, 4A31.
Makeshift code. Urgent. Advise Chief Exley. Homicides at 249 South Arden. Likely major case connected. Request permission to seal under internal affairs autonomy. Urgent that you find Chief Exley. Over.
Assume command. Over.
B1, Roger. Over.
Universal founder Carl Lemley came from a small town in Germany. Louis B. Mayer, who gave us the glory years of the MGM studio, was born in a Russian Jewish village. William Fox and Paramount's Adolf Zucker were both born in Hungary. Fox's studio merged with 20th Century Pictures to form 20th Century Fox.
Here comes Adolf Zucker, the president of Paramount Pictures.
Zucker, known as the father of the feature-length film, spent his childhood in this Jewish village.
I jammed in curbside. I ran up. One lieutenant, one captain. Green. Ed Exley wants this sealed. No press, no downtown homicide. I'm in charge and IA's bagging the evidence. Nods, queasy. Who found them? The captain. Their mailman called it in. He saw blood on a window. He ID'd them? Right. It's a father and two daughters, Philip Herrick, Laura, and Christine. The mother's dead. The mailman said she killed herself earlier this year. In. Smell it. Blood. The entrance foyer floor. Two dead shepherds belly up. Stabbed and cut and forked. Entrail piles. I squatted down and pried their jaws loose. In their mouths, wash rags. Stelfactasnide chloride soaked. Match it up. Cephestion 459. Walk. Look. Think.
Prior to the 20th century, most Eastern European Jews were forced to live in poor villages called shtetls. Without a homeland, they lived a marginal existence at the sufferance of the Russian Tsar.
Rabbi, may I ask you a question?
Certainly, Labish.
Is there a proper blessing for the Tsar?
A blessing for the Tsar? Of course. May God bless and keep the Tsar far away from us.
In these villages, religion and life were intertwined. Everyone spoke Yiddish, the Germanic language of the shtetl. These towns were alive with Yiddish songs, storytelling, theater, and humor that would eventually find their way to America. This rich cultural life insulated the shtetl Jews from their misery and the often hostile reality around them.
The Hollywood movie moguls and their parents came from a place which was like a colossal pressure cooker. The Pale of Settlement in the Russian Empire was the only place where Jews could live legally under the Tsar. They had a very marginal existence, lived in poor villages. There was a tremendous degree of overpopulation. People were constantly migrating around this area. It really was the equivalent of a sort of huge Indian reservation. Not only were people poor, but there were very few things that they could do to earn a livelihood. Their neighbors were often violent. There were tremendous constraints on Jewish life and also a real sense of vulnerability.
Front hallway, broken records, tossed covers, Christmas jazz wax. Confirm the mom peeper letters. The dining room. Family pictures. A dad and two daughters. Mom to peeper. Your sisters. Suicide talk. Suicide confirmation. The den. Three dead on the floor. One male, two female. Details? Their eyes shot out. Shears. Chainsaw. Axe. Bloody propped in a corner. His pants down. Castrated. The women, limbs dangling by skin shreds. I went outside. Blues and a mailman braced them. Did the Herricks have a son? The mailman nodded. Richard, he escaped from Chino last year. He went up on dope charges. Mom, pen pal, same city. Lamster Richie explained it. Spurred you, rash thing. He waltzed minimum security, Chino. Killer Richie? No. Think it through. The Red Arrow Inn. Bed ripped with Cephestion 459 silver. Dead cert. This killer. That burglar. One man. Richie, passive watcher. Someone watching and pressing him. Flirt with the notion. Tommy psycho. Tommy trashes his own house. Now this. Back inside. Exley in my face. Your interpretation? It's Richie Herrick, or it's the guy who broke into his motel room. I'm issuing an APB on Richard Herrick. I don't think this is him. I think we should haul in Tommy K. He's been looking for Richie Herrick. He's got a better chance of finding him than we do. No direct approach on the Cephestions. And I am issuing the APB because the Cephestions are under blanket Fed surveillance, which somehow impedes their ability to search for Herrick.
Without warning, death could come crashing down on the defenseless shtetls. reminding the Jews that as a people they were permanent outsiders, vulnerable and powerless. Before the turn of the century, hundreds of thousands died in pogroms, massacres of Jews.
Suddenly, neighbors kept running out of the front of their house, yelling, "The hooliganas, hooligana, the hooligans are here, Cossacks." They broke down the gate and they came in on horseback, on foot, wielding swords. And my oldest brother and my father each grabbed one of those clubs and they went out swinging.
And now, suddenly, I'm a senior citizen. You're looking so old. And I remember feeling, at first, upset by that because of our culture, and then realizing that in their culture, they were complimenting me.
In retaliation for this attack, we're using the attack as our pretext for an offensive we had already planned. The Air Force proceeded for the first time to bomb areas over the 17th parallel in North Vietnam.
Would you like to say something?
Yeah,
it's a little too subtle. They're trying to sell magazines like everybody else. This kind of scandal is very useful. The sex lives of politicians are of not the slightest interest to anybody. They will read about it if there's nothing else in the paper to read about it. And if you spend $40 million, as Judge Starr has done, trying to get something on the president, he can get something on anybody if you spend that much money. The people aren't all that interested. They're much more interested in the economy. Newsweek's position on all this is simply opportunistic. They have a story to tell. They think people will buy it. People do buy it. There is no conspiracy of that sort. The conspiracy is great money. The American people have never got anything back for their tax money. Finally, Bush did give us a light show, he and Ted Turner in the Gulf. For the $5 trillion worth of debt that we have got as a result of our militarized empire, and that's all we got back. No other country would put up with the lack of services that the United States has. And we keep on saying, oh, God, how wonderful we are. Everybody wants to live here. Well, people from south of the border do when we've wrecked their countries. But I haven't heard of a Swede lately who's moved here.
Jesus, minor mouth. I'm so scarnished. Oh, that's the way my whiskey.
The only problem is that these technologies at present only provide privacy for a tiny bit of our lives, namely the part that consists of email messages.
One evening, it was different from any other. He got us all together in the big auditorium. There he stood on the huge stage. The only light was on him. We were in the dark. Then, out of his tones, came the chanting. First as a whisper, we could hardly hear.
they came back. But there were a few people killed. This was the pogrom. And I lived through it.
This is where the founders of Hollywood came from. This is what they were fleeing and why they came to America. These harrowing experiences are reflected in many Hollywood films. Again and again, images of the rampaging oppressor, of the slaughter of the innocent, and of homes laid waste by fire make their way into American movies. For the shtetl Jews in the late 1800s, life was a series of rapes and murders. Many decided not to wait for a cavalry that would never come.
For the Jews of Eastern Europe, there were three ways to flee. The first was to stay where you were and participate in some Marxist or socialist movement where you could become part of a labor organization that would in turn create a great regime, a socialist regime in which Jews could be accepted as equals. A very small minority began to dream about Palestine. Very small numbers of people became Zionists. You needed a great deal of ideological dexterity to talk yourself into getting on a boat and going to Palestine at the turn of the century. The vast majority of Jews, 2 million out of 2.5 million, who left Eastern Europe to find their dream, went to America. The smart money was on America. It was the simple place where you could imagine the dream of Jews having both opportunity for tolerance and also economic security.
Daughter Billy and heading east to as far away from all this as I can possibly get, to a place where there's more to ritual than snorting cocaine and voting your agent. Though having said that, my relationship with LA is the strongest relationship I could probably muster.
CBC.
I rail against it. I love to hate it. Maybe I'll go to London. But if I left, then I'd probably have to visit LA and say how weird a place Britain really is.
Very narrow communication channel. This problem also is being solved. And the solution in this case is something called virtual reality. You may think I have flown here from Santa Clara, but if we assume this meeting is taking place in 10 or 15 years, I'm actually still at home in Silicon Valley. You are wherever each of you is. Each of you is wearing a pair of glasses which has two little computer screens instead of lenses. And your computer is drawing the picture of me in this room and your fellow attendees 60 times a second in front of each eye, with the result that it appears to you that you are seeing all these things happen. One of the virtues of virtual reality is that Cato didn't actually have to make a solid gold polished sheet wall over there. That's just computer graphics. And in fact, I didn't have to put on a tie today. I hate ties. My computer is drawing this tie for me, which is why it looks much tidier than it would be if it were a real tie.
Something happened a few years ago. Happens very infrequently. About every 90,000 years or so. Anyone alive then, which I assume is anyone who's understanding my English now, give or take a few infants, a few toddlers, got zapped, but good, back in 94. Essentially, enough said. So put that in your pipe and chug a lug. Keep good medicine there. Thus, all the rest happening now. Like a dying star out of Newton, soon to be a black hole. In an analogy near you, WZBC, kind of like a phantom, has its own light source. And does very well in the dark. New metaphysics version every Thursday. You know what this is. In this calendar sequence we have. Marching time. Like military time. You know, Renaissance man. Temporary dominance of the race that was last to arrive on the planet, the white people, needed a little injection of control in there. Left brain, linear, conceptual. Inject a little jism into the body politic, the fluid viscera and so forth. Like a little salt in the broth, right near the end. I don't know, I'm just listening to Reverend Reggie White today, defensive tackle for the Green Bay Packers, talking on the harmony of the races here on the planet.
In your town.
Mm-hmm.
So what virtual reality lets you do is have the illusion of full sight and sound interaction.
The vacuum of spirit into which authority or institutions can move. The dependency they feed on.
One day he meets a friend he knew at school, and his friend says, "Why don't you come down and work where I work? The pay's regular, you're warm in the winter and cool in the summer, the work's easy, we have a bowling team." And so he does. And that's pretty much the end of him. He spends less time in the selection of his career than he does in choosing a necktie.
Just get a sweet
I'm a rather unsexy writer when it comes to politics. I don't think the people have any particular obsession. Or let me put it to you another way. No other country on earth has any interest in the sex lives of the politicians. I haven't heard any, with the exception of England, which we somewhat resemble, or they resemble us. The French, the Italians, President Mitterrand had a mistress. A second family, they come to the funeral. The French find it all very dignified. There is no scandal. Why are we so excited about these things? Well, you get excited because we have the Christian evangelicals out there who hate sin, and they're very noisy. They raise a lot of money. They are tax exempt, and if I were in the Congress, I would tax every church, temple, every religion in the country, and tax their great portfolios and keep them out of politics.
But wait a second, it's not just
be out of it.
It's not just the evangelists. I mean, generally.
It is. If we're to use metaphors, it is as if you and I have a small street fight on a city block. You catch me by surprise. You win. And I choose to come back with my gang and stick a plastic bomb on your house. Your mate loses a hand in the explosion. Your friend, paying a visit, is blown to bits. I send flowers to the funeral and a card offering services as a fire insurance adjuster. Is it possible the ideology of the communists is being opposed by the spirit of the Cosa Nostra? Let me list another difficulty to fighting communism in Vietnam. It is that the communism of the Viet Cong is attached to the local nationalism. With the exception of a few dedicated career soldiers, however, the average American in Vietnam is not much interested in the future of Asia. The freedom-loving spirit of our experts in Saigon has about as much real comprehension of the life of the Asian peasant as the president of the Hilton Hotels Incorporated is on talking terms with his dishwashers at the Hilton Istanbul.
Communicating at long distance over the network, have the illusion of full sight and sound interaction, while in fact communicating at long distance over the network. And there is no reason why you have to be able to know the real space, location, or identity of the person you're communicating with.
Bridge and round.
I had no idea what was about to happen. No one else with me really did at that time at all, except that this field in front of me was illuminated with some very bright, strange light. I noticed that this giant oak tree here was illuminated as well. That was my first indication that something wasn't right. The field.
Apply the technologies I've been describing not to the communication of today but to the communication of 10 and 15 years from now. We have a world where human beings can engage in large amounts of interaction.
Video camera, one was a motion picture camera, and at the time the video camera was a very bulky technology, but I recognized it for what it was. Everything I saw in this field was documented on film that night.
This 90.3 megacycles.
Why do you think we call this snow commercial
on still photographs and on motion picture. There's no doubt about it.
On WZBC.
This is no commercial potential on WZBC.
I saw a walk to the center of the area where this mist was. You can see it clearly. Ground zero would be here. Light moved in. I thought it was an A-10 taxiing to RAF Woodbridge behind me, about a mile. Came in over that. Would be here. Ground zero would be here.
My goodness, you're getting so gray, Ramdas. Like, wow, you're now really, wow, honor is developing. Now, you and I, the issue of change around aging is interesting because we enter into these kinds of conspiracies in the culture. That has to do with aging. And the models, the myths around aging in our society are not the ones that give us great comfort.
That give us great comfort.
We don't think of older people as serene, as wise. We think of them as frightened. We think of them as isolated. We think of them as retired. We think of them as without role, social role.
Large parts of the business of the world in a fully anonymous fashion, in which you can have a reputation without an identity. That is to say, your cyberspace identity is defined by your public key. That's how people prove you're you. And they don't have to know what is the physical body associated with that reputation.
Once upon a time, there lived a rather moody, discontent student who stood alone and looked at the world of books and classrooms with a rather cool and distant carelessness. He was known as Dudley the Dropout, a nice, bright enough fellow who wanted more than anything else to be free and on his own. To him, this wonderful freedom meant first having a car. His own special car, the smoothest, fastest thing on wheels. Secondly, he figured that in order to be really free, he'd have to make lots and lots.
So that the feeling of I'm getting old has in it trepidation rather than kind of joy. I had a very interesting reaction to I found myself saying, what happened was for the first half of my 60th year, I got trapped in all the myths around aging. Because not only were the Western myths strong, which say, well, it's time to fold up your tent. You better complete the work you're doing. Don't take on new things now. No, there are all these kind of models. But there are Indian cultural things about becoming a sannyas at 60. There are stages of life in India. So from 0 to 20, you're a student. From 20 to 40, you're a householder raising your family and making money. From 40 to 60, you start to do pilgrimages and spiritual study. And at 60, you become a sannyas. You're free of all stuff. But you give up the forms of the society. And it was interesting that as I started to get entrapped in these myths in my mind,
I took all of the symptomatology that my body or my personality put forward, and I made them into more and more and more, so that if I felt like I was, I go on tour. I'm on tour much of the time. I mean, I've been on the road for 25 years, about 9 months a year. Now, some people that's horrifying too, but that's what I do. I mean, that's my thing. And I found after a 6-week tour recently that when I got back to California, I was happy to get home. Because I haven't been happy to get home for years. It's just been another place to go. So what I found, interestingly enough, was unconsciously, I started to move in a kind of reactive mode. So I went to Gold's Gym in Marin, and I got a trainer. And it was far out because I figured, well, I'm going to have this body for a little while longer. I shouldn't really just let it decay. I better do something about it. A rather sedentary life, so I take walks and stuff, but I better do something. So it's great. In this gym, there's all these kind of hulks, of both sexes. I mean, really, really something. And there's mirrors all around the wall, and they're all, doing this thing, but I'm nearsighted, so I don't see the mirror. I mean, I don't see myself, so I just see them, and after a while, I begin to think I'm one of them, and I'm so...
Light moved in. I thought it was an A-10 taxiing to RAF Woodbridge behind me, about a mile. Came in over that far stand of trees, stopped over the circular fog-like object on the ground, dispersed in an explosion of color that was soundless, heatless, and what happened was a transformation, somehow, of this mist to a structured object.
So does Paula Jones. There are people there who feel they've been victimized, and a lot of American people feel that lying in itself...
I don't think... Listen, nobody has the slightest sympathy for these ladies, and you know it. Every woman in America sees through Monica, and every man not only sees through Clinton, but rather envies him. That is about the situation out there, hence the 80% rating he's got.
What about Paula? Does nobody feel that he done her wrong?
Paula, who wronged her? He makes a pass at her. She says no, and the agreed upon story on both sides is nothing happened. She was never damaged in any way working for the state of Arkansas. Her name was not dragged through the mud until she threw her name into the mud where it seemed appropriate to rest. She invaded her own privacy in order to get money out of book contracts and out of Clinton to blackmail him. And she has done this. And it'll be very interesting to see what happens. I can't imagine any court upholding her flimsy charges. And I haven't met a woman yet who had the slightest sympathy for her. As soon as they realize that in no way, if you don't go to bed with me, you'll never work in Arkansas again. None of that happened. Also, another little point, which I might bring out as an observer of the scene for some time. Women hit on presidents a lot more than presidents hit on women. They're alpha males. This is 101 biology. Watch a president come into a room and the women become terribly excited because it's biological. The alpha male is represented by the president no matter how dismal he is or how awful he looks.
Know if it's male or female, old or young, but they know that if they talk, if you gave them good legal advice last month, when they hire you to give them legal advice again, they know it's the same person because it's the same key being used for the digital signature.
Self-pity, the anesthetic of guilt, of nobility, the anesthetic of stagnation or of righteous blame. Purity, it becomes a method and a means of growing. So how does one handle fear? Now you've learned all your life. Maybe no one sat you down and said this is what to do, but you have learned all your life. And each person has your favorite way. Each of you, each person in humanity has the way that you've been conditioned, that you've been taught, what we call the consensus methods that, sadly, when used, guarantee that fear will be destructive, that fear will be damaging. The words may be familiar. One is denial. Just to deny. Just to deny. No, I don't feel fear. I'm not afraid. No, I'm not afraid at all. Oh, no, 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 you're wrong. It's not fear that I have. I just, no, no, no. I don't get that. I don't do fear. Yeah. Often one can use the very anesthetics, right? Because I'm afraid I don't want to deal with it, I can use the anesthetics of martyrhood, of self-pity, the anesthetic of guilt, of nobility, the anesthetic of stagnation or of righteous blame, or the stagnation of repression and suppression, or rather the anesthetic of suppression, repression. Just out and out, deny it. And if I can't get away with denial, I have to admit it, then I can discount it. Right? Oh, that. It's nothing real. It's not important. It doesn't matter. It's okay. I'm fine. Really. It's no big deal. The discounting, taking away the value of fear, hoping that it'll somehow go away. Often this is done with pessimism or cynicism. Sometimes with depression as a way of discounting the fear. Others use apathy, the lack of passion. Or maybe you turn to your addictions, emotional, mental, chemical. Some people instead turn to their own arrogance as a way of discounting fear. Arrogance, the lack of compassion. Likewise, one can suppress, seek the perfection, trying to handle it perfectly, better than anybody else. And certainly so, just suppressing it, shoving it deep inside, hoping it'll get lost and somehow disappear in the fray. Denial, discounting. There's also that of defending yourself against fear, making it such that no one is there to say that you might be afraid, because them's fighting words, that you rail them with your anger or with your fears or with your shame or with your guilt or with whatever, or you'll just out and out attack and that same thing. You're trying to convince me of something. You're trying to talk me. You're trying to make me feel weak. You're trying to deny who I am. You won't see who I really am. Never mind. And not only will those who defend their fears against others, they'll do it to themselves. You have done it yourself. With the ridicule, with the diatribe of self-hate. I'm stupid and wrong, and this is idiotic, and I shouldn't feel this, and it makes me so angry, I hate to feel afraid. All that sort of stuff. Even though there's not someone witnessing, you are, your subconscious is, and you can intimidate your own subconscious. Not your unconscious, but your subconscious. By defending and railing against fear as a way of handling it, certainly. And of course, one that's so common, and particularly as you become more sophisticated, as so many of you are, distraction. Creating the straw man, yes? Well, you see, I'm really afraid of this. This is what's threatening me. This is what's putting me in jeopardy. This is what I'm afraid of. But how do I deal with that? So I'm going to be afraid of you. It's easier to be afraid of you than it is of this thing, this etheric thing that could be anywhere. You, I can see. You're sitting right there, and I can keep, you know, my position with you. So I'm going to be afraid of you. I'm going to be afraid of you. I'm not really afraid of you, but it's easier to be afraid of you than it is to be dealing with what I'm really afraid of. So I distract myself. It's sort of like, you know, you lose your keys, and where do you look for them? Under the light? Is that where you lost them? No, but the light's better here. This is what I'm afraid of, but I don't know how to deal with that, so I'll be afraid of you, and I can deal with you. Or I'll be afraid of it, or this, or that, something. Oh, I'm afraid. I'm so afraid I'll wear the wrong color. I'm so afraid. I'm so afraid I'll have the wrong crystals with me. I'm just so terrified. I'm all ready to go. I've got this huge meeting at work that could mean life or death decisions about this or that. Doesn't scare me. No, it scares me. Will I wear the right outfit? Will I get there on time? Will I have the right crystals in my pockets? Will they clang and make noise? Will they fall out and I'll get in real trouble?
For Jews, this was a migration forever. They had no positive views of life in the old world. Many immigrants, in fact, talked about the last moment in Russia where they turn around and spit. In a way, we might even say that they actually became American, or they began the process of Americanization at the moment when they decided to leave, because they knew that there was no going back.
Among these immigrants were the future founders of the studios. They came with little money and few belongings, but they brought with them a new vision of America. Hollywood was a dream dreamt by Jews who were fleeing a nightmare.
Thank you.
numero uno. And that, for many women, is a great excitement. And I can think of Clinton, perhaps, as being the most ravished body since the Trojan War.
Sometimes, groupings of individuals can come together that have complete like mind. And that is truly awesome experience, because then each uses the other in quite harmonious agreement to set forth a greater blossoming of knowledge. You understand?
South, southwest. West. The stems bend toward the east. From the stem, one can determine the four directions. Each direction corresponds to a season. One must simply identify the configurations, place them in their quadrants.
What causes the shapes?
The specter on the fruit is merely the shadow thrown by events in the future.
Whatever gets it for you. And get into that for a moment. Get into a feeling of desiring to become inspired by God. And that's how you start, you see? And then it's not a decided thing. Then it's a lusted for thing. Do you understand?
You can see my breasts, the tops of the cleavage, and my black satin bra.
I've noticed since I've been pregnant,
I've had a lot of fear come up, a lot of memories that were frightening, that I feel somewhere. I mean, it doesn't matter to me when this happened or if I haven't had a child in a long time. Ultimately, I want to deal with what I feel now. And sometimes I feel like I don't even really believe that I'm pregnant. Like, it's not real to me. Sometimes I have a lot of fear still come up, like this is, that there's just been a big issue around this for me. And I have fear come up about whether the baby's okay. And then sometimes I totally know it is. It's just like, it's, I don't know, maybe you can say something around this.
What is your question specifically?
Why is it that I feel like I don't feel the soul in me? I've heard that the soul comes in after the third or fourth month.
Comes and goes. Mm-hmm. And you will see that in your own baby. The mothers in this audience will remember holding babies that were so gone to the world, nothing could arouse them. And at other times, the mere intake of a breath would suddenly cause them to become awake. And babies in deep slumber and jerks back into the body. Souls come and go for 3 years of life.
I feel like I'm afraid of something still, and I don't know if it's important. I feel like when you ask why, if I were to ask you why, then I'm asking you to explain to me what has happened before.
I'll explain to you what's happening right now. You are going to be a mama, Melody. And when you are going to be a mama, a brilliant thing happens to the human body. It is called hormonal increase. The woman begins to prepare to salvage her place on this planet. I am going to be a mama. That means I am God giving birth to life. I am blessed mother. I am the beloved father. I am the caretaker of God, and through this vessel shall pass life. And nothing is more important. That some would call mother nature or instinct. What it is pure thought of God giving life, translated through the soul. It is called woman.
Break against the huge, inchoate spirit of all we are.
Are we the space?
And why do the stars of this spirit's music shine with such intensity upon the double zero of our blinking eyes?
Are we the space?
The questions multiply the mystery.
They went home and told their wives that never once in all their lives had they known a girl like me. Said my house was licking clean. No word I spoke was ever mean. I had an air of mystery. But they went home. My praises were on all men's lips. They liked my smile, my wit, my hips. They'd spend one night, or two, or three. But
that joyous, whatever.
The Your Friend Charlie pawn shop was a glorious place. From the front porch, I heard the flames lick, then eat the trays of zircons, mounted in red-gold alloys. Sunday suits and stolen furs burned in the attics. Radios and TVs crackled with static plugged in only to a racial outlet.
I'm slipping the dress down over my shoulders and my arms, slipping it down over my stomach and over my hips, butt, and down my long, lean legs.
The friendly furniture mart burned higher. When a leopard print sofa with gold legs that makes into a bed caught fire, an admiring shout from the waiting horde said, "Absentee landlord, you got that shit." Lighting by 100 watts. Detroit in 42, New York in 64, screeching nerves, exploding minds, lives tied to a policeman's whistle and a welfare worker's doorbell finger.
You must be responsible in every moment so that no matter what arises, the contraction of feeling attention is not your destiny, your disposition in the moment. You must be able to cut through it. Whatever the experience, high or low. Therefore, the devotee passes through these stages in the way of divine ignorance. Perhaps passes into higher psychic or mystical experiences. Is not fulfilled by any of that. Is obliged to be responsible in the midst of it. To cut through it. To cut through the limitation on feeling attention that even that great vision represents, you see.
Aren't you glad you came? Aren't you?
When they landed in America, the Jews expected to find a place where the little guy could make it to the top. Instead, they found a Protestant elite whose mission was to educate the immigrants and keep them in their place.
The dream with which the Jews came to America was very quickly frustrated. They couldn't get into financial services. They could work for slave wages. They couldn't live in the good neighborhoods. They could live in tenement slums. And it didn't take long before a great number of them began to once again fantasize about what it would really mean to realize the original dream.
Many of the future moguls had fathers who failed to adjust in the new world. At a very early age, they became the family breadwinners. They developed an unrelenting desire to make it, to succeed in the America that existed somewhere beyond the Jewish ghettos.
Jews couldn't be in banking. They were shut out of that. There were quota systems to get into Harvard and almost any medical school or whatever. Any business or profession that was thought to be honorable was in some way or other excluded to Jews. So that they went into businesses that were, in a sense, outside of this system of dominance.
Hollywood's future founders quickly distinguished themselves as risk-takers and innovators. Adolf Zucker made his first fortune with the invention of a fox stole, with a clasp inside the fox's mouth.
The first moguls tended to come from various aspects of the sales business. Dry goods sales, Lemley was a clothier, Goldwyn was a glove salesman, Adolf Zukor in furs, Louis Selznick in the diamond business. And as they approached the motion picture industry, they approached it not from an engineering point of view, not from technology or machinery, but from how they can distribute a product.
You really can't stress too much how pervasively Jewish the movie industry was in New York before World War I. Not that the Jews were making movies or acting in movies, but there probably would not have been an extended Jewish family in New York at that time who did not have some relatives involved in some aspect of the movie industry, which was really a mom-and-pop industry of storefront theaters in not very elegant neighborhoods.
My dad was president of Paramount for almost 30 years. The way he got into the business was quite wonderful. My grandmother, who raised 8 children in 2 rooms above a fish and produce market in a Jewish ghetto in Chicago called Maxwell Street, she came rushing and said, Bonnie, you have to come here quickly. I have the most wonderful business. And she was going on and on and on. And she got him on a trolley car and took him to a kind of storefront Nickelodeon theater. And on the way there, she told him that this was the greatest business in the world because the people paid the money before they got the goods.
Sam ran the projector, and Abe fed the film through it. Harry collected the money, and Jack's assignment, Jack was only like 13, 12 or 13 at the time, but he was singing. Oh.
It all becomes a mass of silliness. It has nothing whatever to do with anything. You throw everything away then. From the heart. But you're holding on to nothing. And even the body itself begins to change into something.
Screen, the incredible source of light, the great generator, the great lamps, into the jungle. Very sharp light, very soft light, very warm light, very cold light, very artificial, very natural. Both, all the time I was working with the opposite.
Francis was shooting Apocalypse Now in the Philippines, and he called me up and he wanted me to come over and photograph the second unit. Every time I went out, I tried to do it in the spirit of the way that they would do it. It was always the utmost thing in my mind. And they were always great. Vittorio would always kind of egg me on. He was always very cute. He'd always go, Steve, he says, we're stuck here with all this stuff. He says, you can go out with this camera and this little unit, you can get all this great stuff. He says, do something wonderful. He says, give us some ideas. He gave me all this encouragement to do whatever I wanted to do, and yet I felt very responsible that what I did had to match, to kind of mesh seamlessly with what he did.
I understood that how it could be important to travel, to go into another country, to use another language, to use another industry, and to interchange energy. There was one idea came to my mind, that there was a possibility to make an analogy between the life and light. The journey that Puyi was doing into himself could be represented by a different stage with the different stage of the light.
Hospitality, Southern style. corn pone grits, and you all smile. Whole blocks burning like brand new stars. Policemen driving their bulletproof cars, saying, chugga, 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 let's shoot that nigger. Trying to outrun us, he can't get far. Watermelons, summer ripe. Baked short ribs and boiling tripe. Supermarket roasting with the noonday sun. National Guard nervous with his bright new gun. Thinking, rumble, rumble, rumble. They ain't even humble. What is that they're shouting? Burn, baby, burn.
How can an artist get money if there's no record company there to get it for them? Or if there's no ownership of an entertainment product? You know, and once the internet goes audio video, there'll be nothing but entertainment product. That's got to go, man. That's way too inefficient. That's way inefficient. So inefficient that it's amazing that we can easily imagine that, but we can't imagine a direct flow from the audience to the artist. All the audience would have to do would be to give a little bit, and the artist would be very well off.
Your mama's took to shouting, your papa's gone to war, your sister's in the street, and your brother's in the bar, the 13s. Right on. Your cousin's taking smack, your uncle's in the joint, your buddy's in the gutter, shooting for his point, the 13s. Right on. And you make me sorry. You out here by yourself. I'd call you something awful, but there just ain't nothing left except the 13. Right on. The 13's right on white. Your mama kissed the chauffeur, your papa did the cook, your daughter did the dirty in the middle of the book, the 13's. Right on. Your sister wears some jockeys, your son he wears a bra, your brother Jones, your cousin, in the back seat of the car, the 13s. Right on. Your money thinks you something, but if I learn to curse, I tell you what your name is, but there just ain't nothing worse than the 13s. Right on. Novitiates sing Ave before the whipping posts, crisscrossing their breasts and tear-stained robes in the yielding dark. Animated by the human sacrifice, Golgotha in blackface, priests glow purely white on the bas-relief of a plantation shrine. Oh, sing, You are gone, but not forgotten. Hail, Scarlet, requisat impace. God makers smear brushes in blood gall to etch frescoes on your ceilinged tomb. Oh, sing. Hosanna, King Cotton. Shadowed couplings of infidels tempt stigmata from the nipples of your true believers. Chant Mater Noster, hallowed little Eva. Ministers make novena with the charred bones of four very small, very black, very young children. Intone D-I-X-I-E and guard the relics of your intact hymen, daily putting to death into eternity the stud, his seed, his seed, his seed. O sing, hallelujah, pure scarlet, blessed Rhett the martyr.
The blemish occurs in late summer, south, southwest.
What do you see?
What do you see?
Duplicity, bale, remorse, glandular imbalance, obscurity, ziggurats, an illegible missive, a soiled kimono, explosions at the mill, laughter behind one's back, misinterment, flypaper, rubber sheets. Rubber sheets. Trench warfare. Tunnel vision. Abasement. Laudanum. Pitch blend. Worthless endearments. Trick cigars. Ink eradicator. Ant farms. Signals through the flames, webbed fingers, travail, weevils in the tea, trouble down the line, things best forgotten, a punctured thumb, misplaced trust, cheap emotions. Faded carpets.
I really am.
What are you going to do now?
Ever since I was a child, I lived with others. My father, my boyfriend, first husband, my second husband. I think I've spent 3 days in my life without a relationship. Before I married Frank, I asked him for a month alone, but he said no. He said he'd waited long enough. It was now or never. Well, I guess I got my wish at last. To be alone, to see what it's like. It's exciting. Scary, but it's exciting. I still have no idea who Frank is with.
How are you going to find out?
I'm not.
One foot down, then hop, it's hot. Good things for the ones that's got. Another jump, now to the left. Everybody for himself. in the air. Now both feet down. Since you're black, don't stick around. Food is gone, rent is due. Cuss and cry, and then jump too. All the people's out of work. Hold for three, now twist and jerk. Cross the line, they count you out. But that's what hopping's all about. Both feet flat, the game is done. They think I lost, I think I won.
And finally stepping out of it completely. And I throw it over on the bed. Do you like the way I look, Phil? My long legs with my black stockings held up by my black satin garter belt. I'm moving closer to you, putting my panty-covered butt inches from your face and swinging my butt back and forth across your face.
Becomes something that we pay a lot of attention to. What do I have to do in 5 minutes? What do I have to do in tennis? What do I have to do in the next hour and the next day? But usually not much longer than a day at a time for most people. Now, what this tends to do is this kind of density of time is to get us into situations where the what I call double forgetting takes place much more readily, because our attentions are what we might call our attention window, as is shown in modern memory research, can only hold something like 5 to 9 different chunks of information at once. And as soon as we get another chunk coming in, it knocks something else out. So you get people forgetting very easily things that they should remember. And a common example of this is that you're in the kitchen and you have something to do in the bedroom, and after you walk the 30 or so feet or whatever it is to get into the bedroom, you're looking at the walls and say, why have I come into the bedroom? I can't remember. The information overload is such that even walking a certain distance in your own home, you can be staring blankly at the walls. I have a number of friends who have gone through this situation, I'm sure that we all have, and it's very disconcerting.
Now, what about Hillary here? Has she not been victimized, or at least humiliated?
Well, I think to say that Mr. Foster was her lover and she shot him and dragged him out to the Potomac Palisades.
I didn't say that.
And covered him with leaves. Oh, come on, those talk radio programs, I suppose, just like this one, were full of this kind of nonsense. No, she's been depicted as a murderess, and I do think that's going a bit far. It all comes back, however, to insurance companies. It comes back to money. The country is owned by 1%. They own, I think it's 90% of the wealth. There's another 20% that is very well off, and they work for the 1%. And they're the ones you send to Congress. They're the ones you hire as a lawyer. You put them on the bench. You hire them for lobbyists so that your corporation does not have to pay any tax. Corporate income taxes have dropped to just about nothing in the last 30 years. So they no longer contribute to the national budget. We, the taxpayers, still provide about 47% of the revenues of the federal government. This is what it's about. And this is nothing but a means of diversion to keep people from ever asking a serious question about why the country is such a mess.
Does Bill Clinton understand the game as you describe it, you suppose?
I wonder. I don't know him at all. I've met him. I know her fairly well. I thought that they handle the thing so stupidly over the national health care. They didn't understand, or didn't seem to understand, who owns the country and how it's run. Yet both of them had gone to the Yale Law School, which is the Vatican of the ruling class, at least for the lawyers to be, and they should have figured it out. You don't strike people with names like Mellon, particularly when united with the name Scaife.
I want to get that straight. It seems to me they didn't. They gave up in face of the insurance companies, and they might have taken a good run at them and said, Canada is a nice, white bread, regular, neighboring, civilized country, and they don't have private insurance companies.
I'm afraid you're redoing the story. They came on far too mildly. When they ran into opposition in the Congress, they then made concessions to the insurance companies,
okay,
when they should have tried to break them.
I agree. Okay.
And they should have made them the target. Didn't do it, and they got it in the chops.
Fair enough. I think we agree. And they sacrificed their own kind of credibility. And especially
it seems to me. Well, he too. He hasn't done anything since. He can't do anything. He makes good citizenship noises about school uniforms and so on. There will be no interesting national legislation from him because he doesn't dare, unless he passes it by the Chase Manhattan Bank and the various corporations that run the place, and he's going to get a no from them, and he's scared, so there is no presidency.
Do you like having my ass rub against your face? Is slavery's chains too long? The clang of irons fall down the years. This brother's sold, this sister's gone. Is bitter wax lining my ears? My guilt made music and my crime when I'm is heroes below. Dead and gone. Dead VC, Turner, Gabriel. I will dead Malcolm, Marcus, Martin King. They fought too hard. They loved too well. My crime is that I lived to tell. My sin is hanging from a tree. I do not scream. It makes me proud. I take to dying like a man. I know it won't impress the crowd. My sin lies in not screaming loud.
With each word your tenderness grows, tearing my fear apart. And that laugh that wrinkles your nose touches my foolish heart. Lovely, never, never change. Keep
keep that breathless
30 feet at the base, 20 feet in height, and a bank of blue lights at the base of it, and mother of pearl or rainbow effect all over. It was very difficult to look directly at. The worst thing to happen to me was that when the event transpired, when there was that transformation somehow, some senior people ran off into these woods, into these fields, and left us here. And why I didn't run could have been shock or whatever, but a number of us ran, a number of us just stayed glued.
Imagine something really preposterous that we prop up and allow to exist in this environment, but we can't imagine the most obvious things that are right in front of us. That, those are the kind of changes that are going to be going on, you know, which you'd say are really fun changes to have, you know.
So that gives you a very odd and interesting science fictional kind of world. People can interact while maintaining as much privacy.
WZBC. This is Crispin Glover, and you are listening to WZBC. At least as so far as we can know things. In a language-only oriented situation. Out of Newton, the mighty Z, still undaunted after so many icebergs in our path, sailing on. New Metaphysics. Every week, it's the same show, just sounds different because you've had various mind control studies done on you without your knowledge. Saves a lot of time in programming to just alter you instead of altering this. It's an offshoot of capitalism, invented in Romania during one of the wars, and then blamed on the Koreans, of course. That's the usual plan. Going till 2 o'clock, in which case the Klezmer Boys will be in, playing live till about 4. Klezmerland. And I'll be back next Thursday, 10 o'clock p.m., with a tape of this show, which of course has been taped and played many times. We have several copies though, so it sounds brand spanking new, just for you listeners. Unbeknownst to you, through an arrangement with your credit card company, cost you about $1 an hour to listen to this station. And we thank you very much. We take alternating vacations with that money, so periodically we have a sub and we go to the Virgin Islands timeshare. Naval Intelligence picks up the rest. It's a good arrangement. Back to tonight's show, we're bringing her on home. Another glorious hour to go in the grand journey's path. The path of the hero, the Grand Saga, inherited in structure from the Northern Europeans many conquests ago. Call it an story. A meta story for the ages. Transporting you from your dismal, reused condition into a glorious, imagined altar of alter ego. Ego timeshare.
Zigzagging about. That's right. If they were airplanes, they would crash into the forest because the runway's over there and they're over there.
To maintain. There are some fairly obvious advantages to this world, as well as some possibly less obvious disadvantages. The most obvious advantage is freedom of speech that is no longer at the mercy of the Supreme Court. You will all remember Mr. Dooley's immortal comment, swallows may follow the spring, but the Supreme Court follows the election returns. And I will be very much happier when my free speech is guarded by number theory instead of by the vote of the Supreme Court. I am more confident that people who would like to shut me up cannot factor 300-digit primes or 300-digit large numbers than I am that they cannot get people who agree with them on the Supreme Court. Somewhat less obvious characteristic is that what you cannot see, you cannot tax or regulate. So if we are moving a large chunk of our interactions into cyberspace with strong privacy, it becomes very, very hard for the government to either tax or regulate those. Now, some people may regard this as a problem. I regard it as a feature, not as a bug. So that means that things like practicing law without a license or running a public, say, running a school without a license or any of those things no longer, I mean, they'll still be on the books in the same sense that nanny taxes are on the books. And if you run for president, somebody might investigate enough to find out you're doing something you shouldn't. But as a practical matter, like the nanny tax, it doesn't get enforced. Because you can't tax things if you can't see them. And you can't regulate things if you can't see them.
There's email for this show at the following address. BlueLight@Hotmail.com. BlueLight@Hotmail.com. Don't necessarily expect an answer, but comments are invited by sentient creatures. And if you can't sentient, just wag a little. And we'll pick it up in our translating device. BlueLight@Hotmail.com for email. If you don't have a computer, just shout real loud. Out the window in the mother tongue, and I'll respond in kind.
distracted myself, so I don't have to face what really scares me.
Leon Suardo.
That's what he named himself. I don't ask me how. Anyway, so he was used to chase the audience out of the theater after the show was over, because a lot of times they'd want to stay.
At the turn of the century, movies reflected the vision of America shared by Thomas Edison and the other men who invented the film industry. Most of these old stock Protestants saw film as an amusement for the working classes. The films presented negative images of hook-nosed Jews, blacks, and others. They championed an idea of America where the white upper classes ruled and immigrants knew their place.
Take one movie, just one movie, biographs, The Fights of Nations. The Jews meet on the street and a policeman comes up to run off one of them who's peddling neckties. One of the other Jews pulls out money and hands it to the policeman as a bribe to let his friend sell the neckties. There is a thread connected to the money. So as the cop walks away smugly, the money pops out of his pocket back into the Jew's pocket. They're petty merchants, they jabber, and they corrupt cops. It's all so perfect. The blacks, they're in a saloon, and a fight ensues in which a huge razor is pulled. So the blacks dance, they fight over women, and they fight with razors. Then two Scotsmen fight nobly with courage and dignity. Then it cuts to the end, and the ethnic groups that are thought to be noble come out into a kind of tableau. John Bull comes out and shakes hands with everybody. Johnny Reb from the Confederacy comes out and takes a bow. The Scotsman comes out and takes a bow. And finally, Uncle Sam comes out and takes a bow. No Jews, no blacks. In effect, immigration has happened, but until the immigrants and the blacks learn what it's like to be old stock, they're not really in it yet.
The highest artistic achievement of pre-Jewish American cinema was the box office hit Birth of a Nation by D.W. Griffith. The explicitly racist story glorified the Ku Klux Klan and played on white America's fear of racial intermixing. These films reflected popular American values of their era. Ironically, they were being shown in Jewish-run theaters to audiences of Jews and other immigrants.
The Jewish tradition has placed an enormous value on high culture, on learning and the finest expressions of music and art. At the same time, the experience of being on the margins meant that your identity was integrally tied to the maintenance of popular culture, collective norms at the lowest common denominator. And that combination of a commitment to high culture on the one hand and an appreciation of low culture or popular culture on the other was the perfect preparation. Adolf Zucker turning to a Sarah Bernhardt for a popular film, I think, is a case in point.
Adolf Zucker believed that to attract the middle class, one had to change not just the theaters, but the films. Bypassing Edison, he imported from France this film, featuring a famous stage actress. He premiered it in a Broadway theater. Not wanting to depend on Europeans for quality films, Carl Laemmle and the other Jewish exhibitors began producing their own films. Open your eyes! Edison decided that the Jews had overstepped their bounds. To shut them out in 1908, he organized a producer's trust that declared a monopoly on film production in America. 7 years later, Edison's trust would lose its monopoly in the courts. But in 1912, to escape Edison and the goons he sent to enforce his control of the industry, the future moguls headed west to the orange groves of California. Here they found immediate success.
Now, why did they move to California? I believe that they went there because California was a raw social environment. And although there was a social system in place, it was nowhere near as sophisticated and nowhere near as entrenched as the social hierarchy in Boston or New York or even Chicago, where these moguls came from. So coming to California, they realized that they could create their own social environment. They could create an empire of their own. Not only on screen, but within their own lives and their own social environment. And that's precisely what they did.
Glover at WZCBC.
And this is because of this temporal density of time. Now, another factor to this temporal density of time, if we go back archaeologically to what we call the Neolithic Revolution, that is the time when man stopped being a hunter-gatherer. This is about, oh, say 7,000 BC. Stopped following herds of animals to hunt that were moving with the seasons. Stopped following the growth cycle of certain plants. And actually stopped being nomadic. And for some strange impulse said, let us settle. Let us stay in one place at one time. Let us see what we can do with this situation. And what happened then was the Neolithic Revolution. This is the New Stone Age. Neolithic, New Stone Age. Now, what happened was the domestication of crops, corns and wheats and barleys and rye, and later on the domestication of animals. Of cows and sheep and goats. You didn't have to go out and hunt animals. You bred them in enclosures so you could have the meat when you wanted it.
It doesn't eliminate government, alas. They can still tax physical objects. I can't eat in cyberspace. I can't physically live and be heated in cyberspace, so they can tax food, they can tax housing. But as long as I am earning income in information transactions and spending it in information transactions, that part of my life is invisible.
In 1915, Carl Laemmle had decided to open a very large plant in the valley north of Hollywood, which they called Universal City, and they got themselves a postal designation for Universal City with its own mayor and its own police force, a gigantic facility that includes all necessities for designing films, building sets, photographing them, editing them, costuming them, writing the scripts, housing the executives, all under one piece of property, which he would people with his relatives, very famously brought over from Laupheim, Germany. And they were very pleased that this was, you know, the first movie-making city in the world.
Let me go on to what is perhaps the least obvious and most interesting feature of this system. Many of you have probably read Nozick's book, Anarchy, State, and Utopia. And in the final section of that book, Nozick describes what he views as utopia, as the ideal human society. And it's a society made up of lots of small communities, each with its own rules. If you're a Puritan, you can go live in a puritanical community with other Puritans. If you're a libertine, you can go live in a libertine community along with other libertines, and so forth. Think about what is called nowadays a listserv or a mailing list, or if you're being dramatic, an exploder. This is a common technology. Those of you who use email are probably all familiar with it because it clogs your email boxes. The idea is that you have a group of people who would like to talk about some common topic. One of these people has a computer, which is set so that when anyone in the group sends a message to that computer, it is echoed back to all the other people in the group. This is the conversation.
Those are fun changes. There won't really be any struggle except, you know, letting go of struggling, you know, which will happen. So that's basically what's in store. So everything that looks like it's a catastrophe or, you know, it's really, you're just not allowing for the fact that you gotta let this old thing die. It's gonna die in every area that you're looking at. The reason that a lot of the so-called sci-fi people, you know, these empirical visionaries, you know, which is sort of an oxymoron, if there ever was one. The reason that sci-fi people are all boring now, unless, of course, you're one of them, is that they can't see beyond this male-dominated reality.
Money to buy anything he wanted, and still leave him plenty of time to just take it easy and practice that fabulous rock and roll delivery on the guitar. Now, to achieve these goals, Dudley decided to unload his books and drop out of school before it was too late. For Dudley, school had always been a place to go because everyone else did. And you didn't make any money cooped up in a classroom. So he quit. And he went swinging on his way to find himself an exciting, prestige job where he could have plenty of fun and really move around. He was sure he could overcome any employer's doubts with his cool confidence and terrific personality. Unfortunately, Dudley hadn't taken any algebra at all. He thought it was just another form of ABCs, and he already knew them. As for physics and math, he'd always believed that those subjects were strictly for brainy astronauts and rocket men. All he wanted was a car. In addition, each salesman was given his own company car. A company car, cried Dudley. That would be really great. He could just see himself cruising to work every day, buzzing past his old high school behind the wheel of his special company car.
This is Crispin Glover.
Among the movie industry's 30,000 employees are men and women from nearly 300 trades and professions.
Following Lemley by 1920, Harry Cohen, Zucker, Goldwyn, Fox, and Mayer had set up their own studios, Golden Shtetls, where each was clearly in charge.
Show me what you are made of. If you have the slightest doubt, be man enough to step aside and let the go-getters go ahead. I will not have quitters or lazy men working for Universal. That's straight from the shoulder, isn't it?
They were tough. They had to be tough. They came up from the ghettos, most of them. They had to survive in a business that was cutthroat. And if they didn't cut throats first, their own would be done. Tough survived, and these guys were ruthless. They used women. They treated stars brutally sometimes. But they had redeeming qualities, too. I mean, they were sentimental. My God, Louis V. Mayer would cry at the drop of a handkerchief. And they were, most of all, showmen. And they loved movies. They lived for movies. And that's a greatness that does not exist today.
We have chikus, guavas, mangoes, ramfa.
Tropical fruit is a bit coarse, I find. The decay lacks definition. The stems are too obvious.
Like them around the room, you know, and but my trainer, you know, there's a point, she said at one point, she said to me, are you all right? And I knew she wouldn't say it to one of those hulks. I realized that she was fact is I was just holding on for dear life to see whether I could catch my next breath. And then I went to the South Pacific for a couple of months in November and December to go boogie boarding. Boogie boarding is a short surfboard. It's made of plastic, and you go out and you ride the waves. And you catch the wave and ride it. And you ride it across the wave, and it's very exciting. So I'm out there, and I'm there with my friend who's in his 30s, and he's a painter, and we're out in the South Pacific having a wonderful time boogie boarding. And I'm out there, and I look around, and there's nobody 60 out there. And there's nobody 50. And there's nobody 40. Maybe a couple 30. The elders. And there's only one place to ride the wave, each wave. And there's about 80 of us. And I'm fighting these 15-year-olds to get the wave. 15-year-old French Polynesian. You know? And they aren't saying, "Sir, you take the wave."
I want to let callers...
I will tell you a story to illuminate that for you, if I may. Right after Saturday Night Fever, a friend of mine, newspaper publisher in New York, went to a dinner and was placed next to John Travolta. And since this guy is not very interested in musicals, he thought he was going to be bored to death by Travolta. So he's making conversation, and he said sort of, "Well, what are you going to do when you grow up, you know, when this movie stardom stuff is all over?" And Travolta said, "Well, I think I'll go into politics." And the publisher was immediately interested. He said, "Politics?" He said, you've shown no interest in it." He said, "No." He said, "I'm not really, but I watch Reagan and all of the others on television, and I understand exactly what they're doing. And I do it 10 times better than they do." There's your answer.
Undefinable. Well, once you have, through this whole consideration of the truth of your condition, become responsible as love, the heart is open, you're starting to grow again, you're human. Then there are some more sophisticated things to be observed about sustenance, about diet and health and gross existence. You observe that in terms of your conventional or mechanical state of existence, you are a very simple process. And the whole of your life is fundamentally a simple process, a complicated play on a very simple process. You are simply reception and release. Inhalation and exhalation. That's it. That's all it is. And the matter of diet and health is a matter of being applied with intelligence to this process, to the law that this process itself is. How do you stay healthy? By being responsible for reception and release. If you're not, You get toxified and enervated. Hmm? Toxicity is a failure to release, to eliminate. Enervation is a failure to receive, to be sustained, to assimilate. So we take the ordinary individual who is just a beast in the desert, allow him or her to consider the condition in which he exists, she exists. Consider this emotional reaction, this metaphysics of separation and unlove, to the point where they can live like the gorilla and be human. And then we ask the individual to observe this cycle of his own existence, his own process in relationship to the great pattern in which he appears, within which he is totally dependent, has not created himself. The process by which you appear is not within you. It doesn't originate in your case. You are simply a reflection of a great pattern. But the process that you represent within this pattern is expressed everywhere in the form of all the processes, all the individuals, all the cycles, everywhere to be observed. And it is simply the cycle of reception and release.
Burgess was the only novelist, and he was as prolific as I am, and he was also, he liked to do different things. He never did the same novel twice, and because of that he had no category, because of that he had no solid reputation other than one of generalized brilliance. He was also a superb lyric critic, and he was the only writer that I would go out and buy a new book by him. Whether good or bad, I had to read it to see what was going on in Burgess's head. He is best known for The Clockwork Orange, which is largely best known for being a fairly good movie. But his Enderby series are marvelous. There are three or four books in this about a poet, and they're hauntingly good. Martin Amis, as a kid, came to interview me, and he thought, he'd never read anything by me, and he thought that it would be good for his career to do an attack. Proved not to be, and just wrote a beautiful essay a year or two ago on my memoirs, Palimpsest, in which he takes it all back. So currently our relations are diplomatic.
Never too late. What did you think of his American novel, this Night Train, the most recent one?
I haven't read it yet. Okay. But we were on television together a few months ago with Salman Rushdie in London. And what was interesting was that with the Smithsonian Institution, I was playing around with quantum physics, which I've started to read a lot about, having no great gift for mathematics. And Martin had written a book called Time's Arrow, which also dealt with it,
right,
which I hadn't read because I didn't want to read anything else on the subject, and I didn't want to be thrown by a novelist. And I ran into Tom Stoppard, and I said, did you read little Martin's book about Time's Arrow? And he said, oh, no, I wouldn't read it. See, I'm writing about quantum physics. So here are three very different writers who are on the subject and who know nothing about it. Makes it even more revelatory.
I'm rubbing against your cock now. That's right. Sitting on your lap, rubbing my ass on the outside of your pants.
It is also a community, a very small community, a very narrow bandwidth community, but a community.
So you began to domesticate crops and animals, and then what you had to do as well is to, you began to make containers for water that were more permanent than, say, skins. You began to develop the skill of pottery. And other objects began to be made as you were a settled tribe.
The first time he was cut in his own vein, and he see for the first time red. Red is the color of the beginning. The color when we burn. He was burning on sea, the blood. He was remembered when he burned as an emperor. Here we go into the scene when the people with the torches are arriving to pick up him. When we see orange in the picture, is the orange the warm color of the family. Is the color of the forbidden city. I was using all the lights around the young tree to give him the feeling of family, of warmth, of maternal embrace. Yellow is color of our identity. When we become conscious, is the color that's been represent the emperor. Is the color that more leads the light, the more represent the sun itself.
There are different ways to work with a director. I have this wonderful working relationship with Marty Scorsese, which I think is the most visual director of all the directors I work with. I remember a shot that Marty hasn't done before, and he wasn't quite sure if it would work. There was a shot in Goodfellas when De Niro and Ray Liotta are sitting in that cafe where he finds out that if he goes to where De Niro tells him to go, he will be killed, that this is like the end of their relationship in a way.
I got there 15 minutes early and I saw that Jimmy was already there.
And what we did is that we did a tracking back zooming in shot where the frame actually did not change. It starts on a two shot and we pulled back and zoomed in, but the background changed totally. And this was something that is quite interesting because it tells you a story. You just start thinking, what's going on? What's going on? I mean, something is changing here, but they still sit there in their booth and talk. But the world around them changes. And I think this is something that I really like to do. And then Marty loved it.
And others who ran that committee, and that it wasn't simply a matter of cleaning up the movies, but at least as the film executives perceived it, it was also a matter of cleaning up the executives who ran the movies and putting real Americans in those positions. So I think the idea somehow that the men who ran the movies weren't real Americans was something that terrified the Hollywood moguls, the Jewish moguls, and they did their best to portray themselves as real Americans, full-fledged aristocratic Americans, and they created their own aristocracy out in California.
But you describe how when big finance moved in and invested in the film industry, that gradually fewer and fewer Jews were represented on the board of directors of the major studios.
That's true. I mean, Wall Street money moves into the motion picture industry fairly early, as soon as they realized that it wasn't a novelty, in fact, but that it was very central to the American cultural life. And as that happens, gradually over the years and accelerated during the Depression when, contrary to popular belief, I mean, the motion pictures industry did not weather the Depression as well as, you know, one might think. Everyone thinks of, you know, Americans going to the movies throughout the Depression and laughing their cares away. And that really was not the way it happened. In fact, almost every major studio, with the exception of MGM, either was in receivership or was in very dire financial straits. So gradually and accelerated by the Depression, Wall Street money and Wall Street, you know, individuals moved into the companies and onto the boards. And as that happened, the power of the Hollywood Jews diminished. Also, they got older, and the power diminished because of that. And other economic changes took place in the industry, television and its incursions. The Justice Department won a consent decree from the motion picture industry to divorce exhibition from distribution and production, and that changed the motion picture industry. And so all of these things ultimately contributed to breaking up what I regarded as kind of monarchies. I mean, MGM, Paramount, Warner Brothers, Columbia, Universal, all of these things were monarchies in which the Jewish moguls were the monarchs. And as all of these other forces came into play over the years, by the early 1950s, the monarchies were beginning to crumble.
As they currently exist, have private law. If I set up a listserv for discussing medieval cooking, one of my many hobbies, if I'm running the listserv, I can and perhaps will announce that anybody who posts on subjects unrelated to medieval cooking will be taking off my list and will no longer receive the messages.
Of little white ping pong balls painted all over.
Once again, Dudley's dreams came to a dead, but very dead end.
Increases with love. The more you love, the greater the fear of loss. That's why often you'll deny that you love because you don't want to deal with the fear. You'll discount it. Yeah, I kind of love, but big deal. Hey, I could deal with losing. That's okay. Hey, if it goes, c'est la vie. Yeah? C'est la vie. Yeah? What comes, goes. What, you know, whatever. And that's it. You know, whatever you say. You can defend yourself against it. by getting angry at the person you love. Getting angry at their little picadillos that yesterday you thought were adorable, today are absolutely... Because the truth is, I'm scared of losing you more today than yesterday, and it's easier to get angry at you, to distract myself and defend myself simultaneously, to say the issue is how you tighten the cap of the toothpaste, or how you stir your coffee clockwise rather than, like you should, counterclockwise. Denial, discount, defend and distract yourself. And distraction is a weird one, because when you distract yourself and say, yes, I'm afraid, I'm not denying, I'm not discounting, I'm not defending against it, I'm admitting it, but I'm admitting the wrong fear. Then when I go to work to handle it, I'm still afraid. Not because I don't know how to handle fear, but because I handled the wrong one. All the beautiful techniques in the world applied inappropriately are not going to eliminate fear. But see, these four ways, they're also additionally another, a fifth way, is by avoidance. There's fear. I'm going this way. Whatever it is, I ain't going to be. I'm going someplace else. Assuming the fear can be contained physically, forgetting that it's emotional, mental, and etheric, I will be with you. Forgetting that it's non-local and therefore is everywhere, or affecting everything.